Hello and welcome to episode 45 of A Positive Podcast. Today's episode is powered by our sponsor, OKClarity.com. More about them later on in the show. If you would like to sponsor an episode in honor of a loved one or a special day, or just because you love our show, please reach out to Razel@JewishPeabody.com or through my website, apositivecoach.com. In addition, if you are curious to hear more about positive coaching and you'd like to set up a free coaching consultation to see if coaching is a fit for you, please reach out through my website, apositivecoach.com. Today's episode is the third and final episode, at least for now, on the topic of ADHD. Today's episode is titled ADHD Part 3, A Conversation with Abigail Gimple. I'm so grateful to a dear friend of mine, Sonny Perlman, who is somebody I look up to and I learned so much from. I initially listened to his podcast. He has a great podcast, check it out. And he was interviewing his sister, Abigail, and they were talking about ADHD. And I realized, yeah, I want to speak to Abigail and hear more about her take on ADHD. So I'm really grateful to Sonny for connecting me with his beautiful sister, Abigail. And Abigail lives in Israel, and she's passionate about helping loved ones who struggle with ADHD, and she shares with us ways that we can support them. I know that I found her to be fascinating, and I really enjoyed sitting down and getting her take on what we can do to support our loved ones who struggle with ADHD. If you have any questions or comments or ideas that you want to share on this important topic, don't hesitate to reach out. I love all feedback. You can email me at Razel@JewishPeabody.com or through Instagram at @apositivecoach or through my website at @apositivecoach.com. I know that you're going to find this to be quite fascinating. So sit back, relax, and be ready to grow. So welcome, Abigail Gimple, to A Positive Podcast. Abigail is a college lecturer, a practitioner in private practice. She's a parent educator, and she is author of Hyperhealing, as well as another book. What's the other book called?
The second book is Hyperhealing, Show Me the Science.
Show Me the Science. Okay. Yeah. And Abigail, I took off your bio from your Amazon. It says a little bit of information over there. It says that you're married for over 20 years. You're a mother of six beautiful children, ages 7 to 19. I'm sure at this point it's higher than that.
Yeah.
And you began your career as a special education teacher in an inclusion classroom with children of all ability levels and unique gifts and challenges. And you loved all of your students, but you found that the most intriguing were the students with the special energy, the ones who were trying to drink from a waterfall instead of a glass, the ones who dreamed all day, but then said something that no one else thought of, the ones whose engines ran on instant gratification and had not yet developed habits and routines to focus their explosive energies. They were creative, they were funny, they were out of the box, and you noticed that they were struggling. And you noticed that they had trouble with follow through, organization, social skills, routine, emotional regulation, and it was time to help them fill their toolkit with strong skills and habits. And in this book, apparently you share intervention program that you developed, which is full of novelty, discovery, structure, routine, and faith in each child's ability. And I'm so curious to hear more about this. You shared that the second wave of your career launched when your children were receiving these ADHD diagnoses, one after the next. And while neurologists insisted that your children had a chronic brain disorder, you know, which could be cured or managed through medication or stimulants, it did not seem that your children's struggles were due to, as you say, a Ritalin deficiency. And so you left no stone unturned in your quest for deeper understanding and solutions. And yes, you're not a licensed clinical social worker or a doctor or a therapist, yet you have life experience and you have a different perspective on how to treat people that struggle with ADHD symptoms. And I am very curious to hear about this. I myself have a few children who have ADHD, some of them with a diagnosis, some without. And I'm very curious to hear more about what it is that you've come to understand and realize about how we have to navigate and help our children with ADHD or our loved ones, whoever it is, kind of overcome these struggles. So please share with us, Abigail, what is it that you, tell us what it is that you've come to realize, your knowledge around all of this. Share with us.
Okay, well, first of all, I want to thank you for inviting me for this conversation. And I feel like we bond over something very specific, which is our children really insisting on bringing out the best in us. And I know that I have a tremendous amount of gratitude to my kids for not letting me just be a humdrum ADHD special education teacher, but really demanded from me to up my game and do the research and figure out what they needed. And that's what really started me on the journey. So what did I discover? I discovered something super interesting, and that was that ADHD diagnosis is, it's a real observable diagnosis, which means that the child is exhibiting certain symptoms. What we're missing from the diagnosis is why. Why is a child exhibiting those symptoms? Now, most people would say, oh, that's because of the brain chemical imbalance disorder, lack of dopamine, a different structural brain, all that kind of stuff. But what I discovered, and this was my huge aha moment, was when it turns out that that's very inconclusive science. And even the most recent studies are not pointing to an overall brain chemical imbalance with kids diagnosed with ADHD. As a matter of fact, the most recent study only points to about 5% of kids diagnosed with ADHD having some kind of varied brain, which means that your chances of your child having some kind of brain disorder are very low. And if that's not the reason, well, it's up to me to figure out what is the reason. Why is my kid still struggling? So whereas I'm not going to say it's a fake diagnosis, because that would be silly, because I'm raising six kids who most are diagnosed with ADHD and they're clearly struggling. It's not made up, but something's happening here that we're missing. And if we don't identify why the kid is struggling and we instead use stimulant medications, and we could talk about that afterwards, because I'm not an anti-stimulant medication person, but rather I'm saying, let's not use that to mask the problem. And then we say, okay, we resolved the problem by giving the kid Adderall or Ritalin or whatever it is we're giving them. And then we don't find out what it was that caused the stress to begin with. And often that stress is being caused between a healthy child, but a properly healthy child, and their environment. That doesn't mean that the environment's not healthy. It means that maybe the environment can't manage this instant gratification, or maybe the environment is the food that the child's eating, or the sleep that the child's getting, or the amount of screen time that the child is exposed to. There are so many, and it could be trauma, stress, anxiety. It could be other things that are going on in the environment, but it's our job as parents, as teachers, as therapists, identify that. Because once we do, we actually can help the child overcome these symptoms.
So you're saying, if I'm hearing correctly, that we should first try to change the environment, figure out what's
the connection, between
to find out what's environment. Right. Find out what's going on underneath.
Yeah.
And then work that way. So when you see, okay, a six-year-old child who has hyper behavior, you know, just can't sit still in the car, has their feet up on the ceiling, you know, cannot sit actually down, you know, cartwheels across the shoal, is doing jumping jacks, you know, rollerblades out, comes out to the Shabbos table with rollerblades on. This is, you know, all the signs of, you know, the hyper part of the ADHD, right?
100%. Now, you're describing my children.
Okay. So what can we do to help this child? I mean, these behaviors are their way of getting, they're releasing their energy. They need to release that energy. You know, one of my children, literally, she cartwheels all around the house, and she came home and she told me her teacher told her she can't cartwheel because she bumped into somebody, somebody got hurt. And I'm like, yeah, it's kind of, it can be dangerous. She literally is cartwheeling everywhere. And it's like, there's a need. She has that need. So what can we do for this child? What can we do to help a child like that?
Well, we can't skip a step. And the step that we're skipping right now is, why does a child need to cartwheel? So your assumption is the child needs to burn energy, needs to behave that way. And my assumption is, I don't actually know.
Oh, okay. So
let me find out. Was the child born by C-section? Does the child get strep very often? Does he have allergies, asthma, any kind of skin issues? Does the child have diarrhea or is the child just not using the bathroom often enough? Is the child not sleeping enough? And therefore, you know, both of us are mothers, so we both remember post-birth, you know, how able were you to focus and have a full conversation? I read in my book about someone once throwing a really trick question at me right after I had my baby. What's your husband's name? And I'm like, well, that is mean. There's no way for me to remember that. I haven't slept in a month. I know I have a husband. Is that not enough? But the point is that if your child is sleep deprived, and we would know that from maybe chronic nose running or snoring or a kid getting up in the middle of the night or bedwetting, things like that. We're looking for things. So if the child is not sleeping, then they're going to be more agitated and jumpy or have mood swings. So we can't skip that. We have to figure out why. So I'm talking about a lot of physiological things, but also if a child's going through some kind of trauma or abuse, their only way of communicating to the world, because they don't have the words to tell us what's going on for them, their only way to tell us that there's something wrong is by misbehaving. So they can't listen to us. And we're saying, well, you must listen. And therefore, what do we do to fix the child? I say, well, let's start by listening. Let's start by being curious. Let's start by asking 1,000 questions and trying to investigate. Will we always find the answer? No. But we certainly must try. And then once we identify it, if indeed your child just cartwheels because she has excess energy, and that's the reason, so that would be part of an instant gratification personality, which is a great personality, and it's healthy, and it's vibrant, and it's wonderful, and she's missing skills because she doesn't know how to not go with what she feels this very second.
Yeah.
And therefore, there's a whole training program, which I offer in like half the book, is actually about that personality type, because there are steps we take to never suppress the curiosity and that drinking from the waterfall part of that personality. And that, you know, when I was just doing this interview with my brother, Sonny Perlman, he was noticing everything around us as we were walking on this hike. And I was saying, you know, that's part of the magic of instant gratification personality. You notice everything. So if you notice everything, you're going to notice the kid who's sitting in the corner and is sad. And you're going to notice a danger that's around you. And so that personality is beautiful. And it also is uncontrolled. And the child and the parent need to learn how to create habits so that she can still cartwheel, but she can know that she needs to wait to cartwheel when she's not around people, and only at recess and not in her classroom and down a hallway instead of in the bathroom. Like, so she needs to be able to learn how to discern that, and she can, but she has to go through that process with an adult who loves and cares for her.
And is not trying to break them, but rather build them. Yeah, that's a very important piece. Absolutely. I love that. I think that teachers really have a hard, difficult job these days. I mean, they're trying to teach children that have like a 3 second or 15 second focus window, that are used to screen time, and they have these children in the classroom, and teachers are really struggling right now. Really.
Oh yeah.
What would you tell a teacher who has, you know, a classroom full of students, and that there are many students who have these focus issues? What would you tell a teacher that's struggling with this right now?
So I developed a program when I was a classroom teacher, specifically for kids with ADHD symptoms. I also, the inclusion setting that we're talking about, I also had gifted kids and kids with dyslexia. It was just a regular old classroom with all the kids in it of that age. And so I developed a system where there were a couple of layers to it. And we have to have those layers in the classroom. First of all, a kid with ADHD who comes into the classroom, the first thing that child's going to do, and I taught boys, so I'm going to talk about boys. The first thing they're going to do is test their boundaries, not because they want to test their boundaries, just because they're afraid and they want to know where their boundaries are. So we have to begin with a very loving and clear boundary of what's permitted and what's not permitted in our classroom. We also have to add to that a very clear communication about success. How can this child succeed in the classroom? So I gave an agreement to my students at the beginning of every week. And the agreement, and it was between me and them, not between me and the principal and me and the parent.
Okay, everyone, just a quick interruption for an important announcement. A Positive Podcast is powered by OKClarity.com. That means they are one of our main sponsors. And OKClarity.com is the place for any Jew, no matter how religious you are, who may be searching for a top-notch therapist, psychiatrist, coach, or nutritionist, and it's completely free. And the cool thing is that OKClarity.com's professionals, they're vetted, and they have extensive experience working with the Jewish community. So if you're in the market for a therapist or a coach or a nutritionist, or if you are a therapist yourself or a coach yourself, you should check them out as well. I'm in the process right now of getting my information up on OKClarity.com as well. They also have a WhatsApp amazing status or group, and they have many followers, and their WhatsApp is a free way to improve your mental health, and they post great humor, so you'll laugh too. So if you have WhatsApp, shoot them a message at 917-426-1495. Again, that's 917-426-1495. You can be added to their WhatsApp group, or you can go to the show notes and just click on the link and you'll be added. So if you're looking for a good therapist for yourself or your family member, look no further. Check out OKClarity.com. Smash those links. You will not regret it. And now back to our episode.
But it was me and them. And we were in dialogue with each other the entire week. They knew exactly what we were going to learn that every single day of the week. And as we went through the day, they had that right next to them. So there was no guesswork. There was no confusion. And keep in mind that a kid with ADHD symptoms, you and I both know as mothers of kids with ADHD symptoms, they lose their way. They forget where they are. They get involved in something else. And then when they come back, they get punished for coming back because they've exited. So now they got yelled at, and now they're a bad kid, and now they feel bad about themselves. That doesn't have to happen. Let's work with the kid. So if you have in front of you your program, and it's an agreement with the teacher, you can ask the question, where are we? I kind of mentally exited here for a minute, and then it's right there. No one's upset at you. You can go right back to it. And there's success in every class because you check off that you're finished. And there's success at the end of the day, and there's success at the end of the week when the whole class has finished their program and we have a fun day because they've earned it, because they've been wonderful and they participated. And when a kid is falling behind, they all want to earn it. They run and help that child. And so that's just one part of the structure where they always can be feeling success. And that's very important. There's another part of the structure where kids have to move around. You know, I teach in college and I stand the entire time. It's 4 hours. I walk around the classroom. I stand. I invite my students to stand up because, like, you know, sitting is the new smoking. We sit too much. It's terrible. So I have lots of different systems of allowing my students to stand and walk around in the classroom. For example, a figure eight in the corner of the classroom that the children can walk on. And when a child has done whatever we agreed on, you got to number five, you're a grand success, go walk on the number eight, put a mirror there. They could walk on the number eight backwards. That's great coordination. That refocuses them. They got to stand up. I'm not sending them out ever to go get the photocopies from the office, because really, that's my message to this amazing kid. You're the photocopy boy. That's all I expect of you. I'm never going to do that with a student because these kids are remarkable. They're so smart. I want them in my classroom. I also put a stentor in the corner of the classroom because I want the kids to be able to choose if they want to sit or stand. Just like I like to choose if I want to sit or stand. And this is a responsibility that the child has, that they have to be quiet while they're standing. And if they are responsible, then they get to do that in every lesson. It's theirs to take. And there's so many other examples of ways I had my students stand up to ask questions and answer questions. And the kid with ants in his pants He, you better believe it, found a question to ask so he could stand up. Not only that, they love that attention. So stand up to ask a question, stand up to answer questions, a lot of movement back and forth. There's an enrichment corner. They could get up and they could walk to that enrichment corner and take out things that are interesting for them when they're finished with what they have to do. So there's a lot of movement dynamic. There's a lot more than that, but let's start there. Children need to be respected. They need to be introduced to the rules. They need to know what's going on. We need to make sure that they're not dragging home with them every single day all of their books or none of their books, because that's our children, right? So we need to be the ones to say at the end of the day, this is the homework, these are the books you need. Invite a kid up to the board to write down, take home your math book, your science book, and your that notebook, and empty out your whole backpack. If I do that with them for 1 month, by the end of the month, they all have a habit. They take home only the books they need and they don't lose their books. But that's up to me. I can't say by the fourth grade, you should just know how to be responsible for your backpack. Now, who did that help? Really? Okay, so the kid missed it. He doesn't know how to do it. Now what? I'm gonna like, okay, good luck to you. No, it's my responsibility to see what habits are missing, what skills are missing, and start at the beginning. And then they do great. They are the best students.
Well, the way you describe it sounds like an environment that's feeding into it. What about high school? What about a high school? High school, will you have like, you know, 15 different teachers, different subjects that are coming, you're going, you haven't yet mastered that skill of executive function where you're able to really navigate all that. What happens with those students? What happens in that?
Yeah, they struggle. They struggle. I've chosen my kids' high schools very, very carefully. And I think we have more options here. For example, one of my daughters, the one who just got married, she was in a performing arts school and she became a dancer in high school. So she, you know, they would daven and then dance for an hour and then do Navi and then dance for an hour. And that was magical because the more movement you have, the more you can focus. I have a son in a school where it's a proper yeshiva high school. And then the whole evening, they're doing metalwork, woodwork, farming, horseback riding, regular bike riding. And his brain is always running. And what's amazing is that he's super successful at those things. So even if the learning part may be more challenging, he rises to the top when it comes to the afternoon. So we do have to give them more structure. They definitely can get help. You know, there's ways to help our high school kids develop those skills. And we shouldn't be scared to pay attention to the skills they're missing. They might still be missing the skills of taking the right books to school or studying for a test. They might have no idea how to do that. So if we are paying attention and we can slow our minds down and stop being terrified of their failure, then we can identify the missing skills and get help for them. Just because they really are, in a lot of cases, more intelligent than the rest of their class.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just by their questions, you can see that their insight, the way they understand things. And they also self-educate, like they're reading books that most high schoolers are not reading because they're curious about these subjects and want to learn more. So they're, you know, reading and getting all this information, but they're not necessarily a straight A student. They're really struggling with the typical testing, the typical systems. Now, most of us can't all live in Israel where they have all these options for these amazing schools. But what I'm taking from what you're saying is, and tell me if I'm hearing correctly, is that we can implement these ideas in our home with our children. So I've heard people share that they, you know, remember from their childhood, and this is years ago, that they did really poorly in school, but after school, their parents really built them up. So they would have baking class and sewing class and this after school activity and that thing they would do with their mother. And they felt like their parents were able to see them for who they really were and show them that beautiful picture of who they were. Like they held them in that positive regard. And they helped them after school hours to kind of put in those programs. And yeah. That's something that I think we can do.
Extracurricular activities are really amazing for these kids. I can say about my husband, who definitely has that instant gratification personality, what that man can do in one day, most men can't do in 3 weeks. It's really remarkable and slightly exhausting to watch. and I'm often in awe. And he really struggled in elementary school. But he was the king of the soccer field and of the football field and basketball, all that stuff. And that balance was like, I'm really awesome at this sports thing. Okay. And I also struggle at sitting still and listening. He actually had to draw his feet on the floor right by his desk to remind himself to put his feet there. That's how hyper he was. And the teachers complained about him all the time, but he was able to get through because he had something else. His life was full of success that wasn't necessarily in the classroom. He did land up being able to succeed academically, and I do give a lot of credit to the sports he did. And I would say also about his son, our son, who is, again, maybe the classroom's not his home, but he's brilliant with his hands. And he actually, at the age of 17, has a little business where he and his friends, they buy little mopeds and they fix them up and sell them. And,
amazing.
That's remarkable. And this is a successful kid. And I'm always amazed by it. And
absolutely.
If we do it right, then there's no reason for these kids to be failures at all. And it's okay to struggle in one area and succeed in another area. Everybody struggles somewhere. And if it's not, oh, that's your ADHD, you're disordered, but it's everybody struggles in some areas and is really successful in others. Let's find your success areas. Then we normalize it completely. And then of course we give support in the areas where they're struggling, but that's not the focus of their lives.
So you said you're not against medication, but you're not for it either. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I have an entire book about it. That's how passionate I am about this subject. And so I'll tell you, I did medicate three of my kids. And I was doing the research on medication while I was medicating them. And the response they were having to the medication was probably what forced me to get into the studies. And once again, I'm super grateful to them for that. What I've realized is Ritalin and all of these other medications, and I have a hard time calling them medication because in my old-fashioned mind, medications heal. And these do not heal. They mask. And you know what? Sometimes masking a problem is a value. And that's why I'm not against it in terms of I'm never going to say, don't ever touch this thing. It's poison for you. But the problem is that if we use that as a solution and we use it as a long-term solution, in many instances, it does harm a child. And we know from the research that about 1 in 10 kids who is taking chronic medication will land up with a secondary psychiatric diagnosis. And that's a big deal. So
say that again.
One in 10 kids who takes chronic medication, that's usually over 3 years, is okay. Gonna land up with a secondary psychiatric diagnosis. So you start with ADHD, you land up with bipolar. That's what's, or schizophrenia, or a, listen, there's so many choices.
Wow.
Depression, things like
one
that.
One in 10,
which is really high.
That is.
And there's a lot of American kids that are walking around with a secondary diagnosis and have no idea that it's very likely that their ADHD medication is what got them there. And this is well documented, and I have that in the studies in my book. And we do know that it actually the medication perturbs the neurotransmitters. That's the goal of the medication. And therefore, if you're constantly perturbing the neurotransmitters, you're going to land up causing a situation where the body is always trying to get into balance again. So if you are causing the body to produce less dopamine because you're trapping the dopamine within the synapses of the brain, it's getting a little sciencey here, then your body starts producing less dopamine. And then we say a kid with ADHD produces less dopamine, but did he always produce less dopamine? No, his brain was healthy. And so the medication was causing it.
So that's similar to addicts, right? They're taking drugs because they have some kind of pain. They want to experience dopamine, right? And they want that release. And then they come dependent on it. Their brain stops producing dopamine on its own because it needs the drug to produce it for them.
Yes.
So it's,
And we get the same issue with gamers as well. Addictive gamers have right. the same issue. So they constantly need another hit. But this is an innocent child who is 6 years old and is being put on a drug that is causing an imbalance in the child's brain. So it works. It works great because if you make sure that that dopamine is trapped in the synapses and it keeps firing, you're going to keep that child hyper-focused on what he's doing. So excellent, except that that wasn't the problem to begin with. Like I said, it's not a lack of of Ritalin in your child's brain that's causing the problem. Something else is causing the problem. So we have the child become dependent on this drug, and then we pull the drug because the child's like, I don't want it anymore. It's too much for me, or it's not working. Or we see that it's stealing the child's personality or causing physiological symptoms like tics other thing, kids start scratching their skin a lot or they get depressed. So you say, okay, this is not for this child, and you pull it, but then the child's behavior is worse than it was to begin with. And you say, well, they need the medication. No, the behavior is worse than it was before because of the imbalance of the neurotransmitters in their brain. And we need to have a lot of patience. When I pulled one of my kids off of Ritalin, and by the way, it's something that has to be done slowly and with the help of a doctor, because of this worse rebound behavior, you don't want to do it alone. But if you are planning on taking a child off medication, stick with it, because it takes at least a month. And you're getting off easy, because getting off of any other psychiatric drug takes a whole lot longer and is a way more painful. So the fact that you can get off an ADHD drug in a month is really a blessing. But I said to my son's Rebbe, I said, listen, it's going to take a month. So don't panic. His behavior is going to be worse than it was before. And he's a sweetie kid. And for a month, he raged. And every 3 days, the Rebbe called me and I said, you forgot. It takes a month. And I am telling you, you're going to get him back. We're all going to get him back. But we have to be patient and loving and not punish him for something he can't control this very minute. And we did get him back. And then we put him in horseback riding, and then we put him in car repairs. And then we built his world up again. And we could do that.
Baruch Hashem, that's amazing. Well, I wonder what the statistics or the research is around kids that have ADHD or have been prescribed medication for ADHD and addiction. I wonder right. if there's a connection
is, correlation. There's definitely a correlation. And if you speak to people who have become addicted to other drugs, often they started with amphetamines. That was their gateway drug, and that was prescribed to them. And then they went on from there. I don't have very specific numbers on that, but very frequently the prescribing doctor will say, you must get your kid on amphetamines or norepinephrine or whatever it is that they're giving in order so that your child doesn't get addicted to drugs later on. But yes. It, very often the inverse is really what's true.
I've heard both of those, and that's what's so it's confusing to navigate. A parent who's, you know, has the teacher tell them that, you know, this child is really, it's not working. You need to put them on medication, and the doctor saying it and the school saying it, and you're at loss. What am I supposed to do? And then it's challenging to navigate, and doctors are so quick to prescribe.
Yeah. That's actually why, I wrote the second book. Because I felt like we must educate ourselves. And even if we decide to medicate, we need to know, we need to make informed decisions. We need to have the full picture, because when you sit in the doctor's office, you have a 2-minute conversation with the doctor, and you don't really get proper informed consent. And for any decision you make, it's really up to us at the end of the day what goes into our kids' mouths. And if we don't, if we're making decisions blindly, then I feel like we're letting our children down. And it's too much to swallow. Every mom can't go out there and do all the research. And that's why I felt like I really wanted to put the research out there so that you don't have to spend the next 10 years reading every single study. I like reading studies. It's a little nerdy, but I really enjoy it.
I get that. Can you share with us what your book is going, like, I didn't read your book. I haven't had a chance yet. I do plan on ordering it and reading it. But what are parents going to find in your book that's going to be helpful to them besides, you know, all these studies of information and, you know, research?
Right. So the research really is focused in the second book because not everyone wants to know the research. For me, it was like, I must know. And I, you know, really dove into it deep. But really, a lot of people are just like, I need the program. I need to understand what's going on for my child and what to do. And that's very respectable. We're super busy. So therefore, the first book, which is, it's quite a big book. It's also available in audio, which makes it easier for parents who are on the go all the time, because we all are. We're really busy people. And I don't know anyone who's busier than moms. So the book is it's my full intervention program. Like if you were to come to meet me for coaching, then that's what we would go through. And what I realized is that a lot of people can't afford coaching. It's just so expensive. And sometimes it's really ongoing. And also, one person cannot address the needs of that many. So that's why I sat down and wrote the book. It wasn't my intention ever, but I felt like if parents could get this in their hands, they actually can identify their child in the book because there are so many causes of ADHD. So I really present all, and you can't present all of them, obviously. I present the most pressing causes of ADHD symptoms. And then as you read through the book, you say, well, that's my kid. And so many people come back to me and say, how are you in my house? How do you know what's going on in my house? I'm like, because it's going on in my house. I'm with you. You know, I'm not, this is not no ivory tower going on here. So it's all the programs that I offer my clients, and you can do it on your own just for the price of the book. What I do recommend is that parents get together to do it together, because even though it's very easy to follow, I have a cheat sheet at the end, because a lot of the parents have ADHD symptoms themselves and they're producing these adorable ADHD kids. That's that special energy we're talking about. And so therefore I really encourage friends to get together, read the chapter at home, and then come together, make a WhatsApp group, make a commitment to follow up with each other, because at the end of each chapter, I also have an action plan. So you know exactly what you're supposed to do now. So if you can do that with a friend, with a group, with your shul group, with whatever it is that, you know, the closest people you have, with siblings, then you can actually see tremendous progress. And my goal is that you don't need to come back to me. You can if you'd like to, I'm always here for you, but you don't have to. And you can really have a full intervention program on your own. I also include a bridge to school. So a lot of the ideas I talked about for school are in the book, and help with social issues, help with sleep, help with diet. It's all there. And if you see that your child's struggling with any of those things, you go to that chapter and I'll hold your hand through it and really give you the guidance you need.
Love that. So I've also seen that ADHD can be a superpower for like many people, that they can do so many things. Like you mentioned your husband before, juggling so many projects, et cetera. When somebody who's not ADHD is married to somebody who is ADHD, what would you recommend and share with somebody who's married to a loved one, a spouse that has ADHD? What would be some tips or tools that you would advise them on how to navigate that better?
So I would say, and it's funny you're bringing that up, because I just spoke to someone the other day and said, we really need support groups for the wives, because it's not so simple. And the first thing that comes to mind for me is you have to have clarity. These are entrepreneurs. They just go for it. You know, they're like, you know, they're lone rangers. They have an idea and they're out the door with their idea very often. And you have to figure out what you need, and you have to have a tremendous amount of clarity. Just like when you meet them in the classroom when they're in third grade and they're not sure what their limits are, and they get confused and lost when they don't know what book to take out and what to do next, and they get frustrated, that same person grows up and has the same frustration as an adult. So we, as the partners, really have to give that clarity, be very clear in our communication, write things down. The nicest thing I could do for my husband is just sit down with him with a calendar and just like fill it out together. This is what the next few weeks are going to look like. So I'm not springing anything on him, but they're so generous and want to give and want to share. And they're going to railroad you into what they want unless you say, hey there, I'm here and this is what I want and this is what's going to make me happy. So that clarity is definitely the first step. A lot of patience and understanding your partner is not disordered. Your partner has an instant gratification personality. So cash in on that part. We go out on hikes all the time. We're like the most spontaneous family ever. And it's fantastic. And so cash in on that, enjoy that part, but also demand a structure and help build that together.
So it sounds like you're the only one in your house who might not be ADHD. This sounds like a party.
I'm so totally the only one in my house without ADHD. Our Shabbos table is so much fun.
I love it. And usually that's the happiest, the most fun house in the block is those homes that have a parent that has ADHD or maybe both parents.
And yeah, I don't know if we ever have a Shabbos meal where my husband doesn't get up on a chair with like a knife in his hand, because that's a sword, as part of his Dvar Torah. Like it just doesn't happen. There's different voices. It's like, you know, there's so much drama, but you know what? The kids like it and they want to do it in their homes one day.
Love it. It's so beautiful. It's really a beautiful thing to keep in mind. And I would just want to clarify, it's not just a wife support group. There are many women that have ADHD too.
100%.
And they're maybe married to somebody who's more neurotypical and they, so it's an important thing to keep in mind as well. Okay. Right. So that's an important thing. So I've heard you say that you're not of the belief that, you need to get a actual formal diagnosis. You don't need to take the time and take your child or your loved one and get a neuropsych eval or, you know, actually have a diagnosis to work with. What are your feelings on that?
I don't tell people not to get a diagnosis because their diagnosis can be valuable for a few things. First of all, if you are planning on medicating, you need a diagnosis. Second of all, in order to get services, it's much more valuable to have a diagnosis. And if you can get free services or cheaper services in your school district because you have a diagnosis, then go for it. There's no reason why you should be paying out of pocket. In terms of getting a diagnosis for ADHD, I don't think it adds a lot of wisdom and knowledge. It's kind of like, you know, I suffer with migraines. So I go to the doctor and then to a neurologist and I say, listen, you know, I have them all the time. It's on my left side and you know, it's pressing. And this, I give all the description and the neurologist thinks for a few minutes and he does a little bit of, you know, poking here and there, a couple of questions. And then he says to me, okay, so I know what you've got. You've got chronic migraines. And like my mouth drops because I just told you that I have headaches all the time. So what you're doing is repeating that back to me with different words. You just wrapped it up with a different bow. Okay, so how does that help me? ADHD diagnosis is a descriptive diagnosis. So does it shed light on what's going on for me? No, I already knew what was going on for me. I already knew that myself or my child was struggling to focus and stay organized and not lose things and all that. So it's only that. So I'm always amazed when people are just blown away when they finally get that ADHD diagnosis. I always knew there was something wrong, and now the doctor has organized my entire life for me. Like, what did the doctor do to make to bring more clarity? You still have the same symptoms, and now he's called it a thing. Okay, right. Great. So for me, what's most important is why and how do we get started? And that's it. So get your diagnosis for sure. And not only that, I do send people for a psychodidactic, that's what we call it here in Israel, because sometimes you've got a learning disability that you haven't identified and that will also cause ADHD symptoms. So if I have a feeling that the child's learning is what's off, then I definitely want a psychologist to take a deeper look at it and give some guidance.
Right. Do you believe there's a difference between ADHD? Is it possible for people to have ADHD tendencies and not necessarily have ADHD, meaning they could be hyper, they can be not organized, they could be, you know, loud or rambunctious and move around a lot, but not necessarily do they have ADHD? Is it possible to have ADHD tendencies?
I think we all have ADHD tendencies. Like I'm a very high energy person, like very high energy. My sister, when she was watching me cook for the Shabbat Shem Rechot for the 60 guests, she's like, no one does that anymore. Why are you not catering this thing? Because I can. It's okay. And my food comes out better. But is that an ADHD tendency? It's high energy and that's good. The way that they diagnose now, like the DSM-5 diagnosis, you can get a diagnosis on partial symptoms, on ADHD tendencies. It doesn't really have to like actually get in the way of your functioning, because it's getting easier and easier to be diagnosed. And that might have something to do with the connection between the people who publish a DSM and the pharmaceutical companies. But there's definitely, so ADHD tendencies exist, but that just means a part of your personality also is a little bit flaky and you have a harder time getting organized, in which case, well, let's work on building that skill. And you're an awesome person and you're very creative, and that's the area you need to work on.
Love that. Okay, so I have a last question for you. It's the question that I ask almost, you know, all my all the people that I interview. What is something that you thought you knew really well about ADHD that you were definitely sure about? But after years of life experience and your research and working with people with ADHD, you've changed your opinion on or view differently?
That's a great question. I think that, you know, as a younger teacher and mother, I thought that, you know, good intentions and preparing good lessons and being an interesting person was what we needed. Like we needed to be loving. We needed to come to the classroom prepared and that everyone would learn. And boy, was I hit in the face with, no, that's not the way it works. You have to really go deeper and figure out who these people are. And really meet them where they are holding and understand their personalities better.
I like that. That resonates. So is there anything else you want to share with us before we end today? Any other parting statements or anything else that you'd like to share?
Well, I always invite people to be curious. And I always, for myself, I always invite myself to be grateful. Often when I remember this one woman was in one of my groups, and she had two of her children dying. She had two children and they were both diagnosed with ADHD. And she said, I don't know if I want to have any more children because I produced these two broken kids. And that broke my heart, because she had two wonderful, healthy children who were struggling. So I think for us as parents, our first step is to look at our children and be amazed. Be amazed that they're ours. Know that Hashem put us together with them because we're a perfect match. And know that they're going to bring out the best in us while we're bringing out the best in them. And wake up with gratitude. And when things are not going well, know that Hashem's with us and that there will be, the next step will be well. And just always say thank you. And that's really been, for me, a major guiding light. And my daughter just got married and she left. I know I keep repeating that because I'm probably still tired. But she left us a note the night of the wedding. And so when we got back from the wedding, like broken and exhausted and very grateful and happy, it was a sweet letter there. And one of the things she said to us was, thank you for always believing in me. Because she had a crazy bumpy elementary school career, like over the top. I know that I'm sure there's a lot of mothers out there that really can relate So like being in the school once, twice, three times a week, every week from first grade through eighth grade, being told she's going to land up on drugs and be land up in jail, like crazy stuff. And she knew that we believed in her. And today she's such a beautiful Chatan, and she's built such a beautiful person for herself. And I think that our gratitude and our faith that our child is healthy and wonderful and is going to take those steps is very powerful.
It really is. It's very hopeful, and it is such a really important message for us to keep in mind as we're raising our children, that we will have bumpy roads and difficult days, and it's not all roses, but
no,
there is
no
light.
No one promised us roses.
Right, but there's light at the end, and that if we keep holding them in a positive space and letting them see themselves through our lens of who they are as a beautiful person, not a broken person, they can really flourish.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Avigail, for sharing your time with us. And this has been quite insightful and interesting. And thanks again.